tomorrow for another edition of Now.
From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Modi become India's new prime minister. Thailand's coup leader warns he will use force if protests flare up. Analysts consider the political picture in Thailand. And an NGO praises recent anti-hunger efforts.
For the first time in human history, we have the prospect of ending global hunger within a generation.
It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. India's opposition Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party is putting together a new government by formally choosing Narendra Modi to be the country's next prime minister, following a resounding victory in national elections. BJP won 282 seats, far more than most analysts predicted, and the Congress Party took just 44 seats. For some analysis of the shift in leadership in India, VOA's Carol Castiel spoke with two analysts. Lisa Curtis, Senior Research Fellow in the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation, and Michael Kugelman, Senior Program Associate for South and Southeast Asia at the Wilson Center. Here is Carol Castiel.
Well, Lisa Curtis, let me begin with you. So does the BJP and Narendra Modi's victory, in your view, signal a decisive shift in Indian politics? And if so, why?
I think so. It's quite remarkable that the BJP has won a majority of seats. This is the first Indian political party to do so in 30 years. So I think it shows that people were tired of the Congress party, the malaise that had set in with that government, the sense that the Congress government was out of touch with people's concerns, whether it be corruption, slowing economic growth. And I think Narendra Modi was really able to connect with the youth population of India, which is ironic because Rahul Gandhi of the Congress party, of course, is a young leader, but he was a disappointment. He just was not able to connect with the people in the same way that Modi was able to. So I think it does bring a change, and I think there'll be some opportunities for the U.S. with this new BJP government, but there may also be some challenges as well. And with regard to opportunities, I would say because they're likely to have a more decisive, robust foreign policy, this may open opportunities for defense cooperation, cooperation in the Asia Pacific. When I talk about challenges, I'm referring to the fact that we may see increased tensions between India and Pakistan because, of course, as you mentioned, Narendra Modi has a somewhat controversial past. Some perceive him as being anti-Muslim and very hardline. So I think we'll have to see what happens. But I think from the U.S. perspective, we're going to have to be on our toes and watching very carefully to ensure that Indo-Pakistani tensions don't escalate.
Let me turn now to Michael Kugelman to get your view, Michael, of the landslide victory. What factors contributed, in your view, to this incredible victory and defeat for a Congress party?
Well, essentially, the majority of Indians just concluded that the Congress party no longer represented what India should be. Not only was it so unpopular, it was seen as the party that presided over the collapse of the Indian economic miracle, and also it had gotten caught up in so many corruption scandals that involved so much money, billions and billions and billions of dollars. So there was that, and I think that people were just ready, particularly the young people, but people across the board, particularly those in urban areas, that increasingly can understand that this Congress party model of emphasizing social welfare policies, subsidies, that type of thing, that in of itself cannot be a sustainable policy in terms of economic governance. And the BJP, and specifically Modi, brings a whole other way of looking at this issue. He's much more focused on market solutions, and he certainly has had great measures of success in Gujarat, in the state where he's been chief minister for a number of years. One couldn't say that there are economic miracles there, as he oftentimes depicts his accomplishments there. But essentially, Indians have concluded that it's time for something new. And I think so keen were they on having a change that they were willing to overlook, including some Muslims, I believe, overlook Modi's baggage, which is significant.
We'll talk about that baggage. But first, if in fact this was a vote against the Congress party and for a new economic strategy, what does it mean for the Congress party? How will they regroup?
I think that they're going to have to reassess their leadership because, as I was saying, Rahul Gandhi was a major disappointment. So I think that they will have to think about how they move forward and with what leadership. They have to find policies that connect better with the youth of the country. And as Michael was saying, perhaps reconsider their economic policies. Really, the Congress started falling apart during its second term. And this was largely because Prime Minister Manmohan Singh did not seem to bring the same energy to the position that he did in his first term. And whether this is health issues or something else, it's not entirely clear. But I think what happened is when the corruption scandals did break, that the Congress leadership just did not handle them correctly. Congress definitely bears responsibility for its loss of popular support. But at the same time, we're seeing tectonic shifts among the Indian population. And because of social media, because people are moving into the middle class, India is becoming part of the global economy. Because a lot of these shifts in the polity, I think the Congress party just simply wasn't able to keep pace with the social changes that were happening. And the BJP, on the other hand, had a very tight campaign. Modi was very active on Facebook and Twitter. So the BJP just understood how to connect with those younger voters.
Back to you, Michael Kugelman, briefly to comment on what you think this loss means for the future of the left-of-center Congress party.
Parties like Congress, which are dynastic, dominated by political families, they don't go away easily. So it's not going to be disappearing anytime soon. But I think it's certainly going to need to retrench and really think about its future. And policy shifts will be a necessity. But I would emphasize, and Lisa hit on this, not just policy changes, but also just it needs to change its general attitude and how it regards India and Indians.
Michael Kugelman is Senior Program Associate for South and Southeast Asia at the Wilson Center. He and Lisa Curtis, Senior Research Fellow in the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation, spoke with Carol Castiel, host of the VOA program Encounter. You can hear more of their discussion by going to our website, voanews.com, and look for Encounter under the Programs tab. Thailand's coup leader says the palace has endorsed his takeover of the government. The army chief, who carried out the bloodless coup last week, also issued a warning about any challenges to military rule. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from Bangkok.
General Prayut Chan-o-cha, clad in a dress white uniform, appeared in an army auditorium following the issuance of a royal command, declaring him to be the head of the National Council of Peace in order to run the country. The document states that the army chief had warned the palace that violence in Bangkok and other parts of the country was likely to spread and may jeopardize national security. The general told reporters he hopes the problems will be solved soon so he can return to the right democratic system. The army chief says it is preferable to have a prime minister and elections soon, but he is giving no timeline for achieving that. The general seized power last Thursday, ousting the caretaker cabinet 2 days after he declared martial law in effect. These actions came following more than 6 months of political turmoil and low-scale but sometimes fatal violence at sites where rival rallies were being held. The head of the junta is now directly cautioning the media and people communicating online not to incite conflict. The general also warns that soldiers will forcefully crack down on any further political protests. Over the past several days, small but vocal crowds composed of hundreds of people have gathered to oppose the coup in Bangkok. Soldiers and police have been restrained and ultimately not confronted the demonstrators, who appeared mostly to be ordinary citizens, not the hardcore protesters seen at organized rallies in the past. But a Sunday protest did include some recognizable organizers from the Red Shirt Movement, which supported the ousted government of Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawat, who was taken into military custody last week. Among those at the anti-coup rally Sunday, which occupied for several hours a McDonald's restaurant, was a woman who only wanted to be identified as Belle.
Ordinary people just who anti the coup just come out. That's it. No leaders.
No leaders.
So everyone just responsible for this country, so that's why they come out.
What do you think is going to happen next?
We don't know what to say because, you know, it's very difficult to get the situation at the moment because the junta government is very, very fierce at the moment. So what are we going to continue to protest like this?
Receiving the blessing of Thailand's revered King Bhumibol Adulyadet is a critical step in establishing the ruling junta's legitimacy. Past coup attempts in Thailand that did not earn the king's blessing ultimately failed to overthrow the country's sitting government. The king, who is revered among many in Thailand as a demigod, has not appeared in public since last week's military takeover. The coup leaders said Monday that the 86-year-old monarch was not in the capital and did not meet in person with General Prayut. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
The coup in Thailand has drawn international criticism. The U.S. Defense Department says it is canceling ongoing U.S. military exercises with Thailand, as well as planned visits by U.S. and Thai military officials. Mark Thompson, director of the Southeast Asia Research Center at the City University of Hong Kong, tells VOA's Victor Beatty there is no question the military sides with the anti-government yellow shirt protesters.
The military stepped in now for the third time, 2006 coup, then the behind-the-scenes effort to change the government, to unseat the pro-Thaksin government 2008, that was after the airport occupation, and now. And each time the military has shown it clearly sides with the so-called yellow shirts, the traditional elites who oppose Thaksin, who are, you know, based in big business, the bureaucracy, the courts, and have support in the monarchy. This is a step by the military which clearly bolsters the anti-Thaksin side, and you can see that in the people who have been arrested largely from the government or supporters of the government or people who have expressed sympathy towards elected governments, and the way in which the anti-government protesters have greeted this coup. This is what they've been calling for all along. So the military has stepped in a very partisan way. There's some ominous signs given the numbers who have been arrested. Some reports it's up to 150, that this is a much harsher coup than the previous one. And there's even some worry and discussion that the Thai military could be thinking along the lines of the Egyptian military last year, that it would harshly repress a popularly elected government, in this case, the pro-Thaksin forces.
How is this going to impact U.S.-Thai relations?
Adversely, obviously. The U.S. has been very critical. And I think criticisms will only mount, particularly if high-ranking government officials like the former Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra, the sister of Thaksin, it continues to be held in a location we don't know where it is. She has no contact, apparently, with the outside world. And if this continues, there are other high-ranking government officials, redshirt leaders, pro-Thaksin redshirt leaders, academics, journalists, and so on. So this is a real worry. And I think one interesting aspect is within the pro-military yellow shirt traditional elite camp, there's been growing disappointment with the U.S. And there's been some discussion, although it's hard to tell at this point how serious it is, about a military government even moving more toward China, because U.S. criticism suggests that a Thai military government can't look anymore to the U.S. Whether China, of course, would be interested in such overtures is unclear. This is speculation at this point, but it represents an interesting development in Thai politics, because historically, these traditional elites who the military clearly backs have historically had close ties with the U.S. Now that relationship is very much fraying, and U.S. criticism of the coup is disappointing these traditional elites.
University of Wisconsin history teacher Tung Chai Winnachakul says the Thai military has tried to learn the lessons of the last coup in 2006, in which Ms. Yingluck's brother Thaksin was ousted as prime minister.
Their lesson in 2006 is that, this is what they say, don't repeat the mistake of 2006, because at the time, we are not strong enough. We didn't do things decisively. This time we must.
How is this going to end?
I don't know. It is the beginning of widespread and strong suppressive measures. It's like 1976. I was part of that. I know the situation at the time. It's like 1958. That I was too young to learn, but let's say I learned it from history. Not every coup in Thailand is like this, to the point that many have illusions that Thai coup is somewhat relatively peaceful. That's not true. Normally, violence comes after that. But this is one of the rare coups. The violence started from the beginning, and the widespread purge, widespread suppression going on for a long while.
So you expect the military to stay in charge for a while?
For a while, for sure, but I don't know how long, because it's hard to predict in terms of time. But I can say what is the criteria to return to elections. The criteria that they have to make sure that elections after this must produce the outcome they want. The mistake, in their view, in 2006, and then even given the Constitution 2007, which they themselves push it, even though a huge number of people disagree, vote no in the referendum. And but let's say, and they argue that, just vote yes first, convince many people, vote yes, and then you can revise, you can amend it later. It turns out you can't amend throughout the year. The lesson they learned in their view is that all of this have not enough to produce the outcome they wanted. So that's a mistake in their view. This time, they want to make sure that the outcome of the next election, whenever it is, must produce an obedient government who doesn't have enough power. Elected authority must have limited power, supervised and under the dominance by the appointed authority. So the military has been on the side of the PDRC, the protesters, the anti-government protesters, all along in the past 6 months. They provide shelter, they provide security to these people to the point the police force cannot do to them. That's why you see the protests in Bangkok. They can march where too many places they can apply extortion measures at will because the military protected them.
Meanwhile, Human Rights Watch has criticized the military's arrest of at least one human rights activist and her son, and says their whereabouts remain a mystery. HRW Asia Director Brad Adams insists they are being wrongfully detained.
It's different than the previous roundup in the last few days, people who were involved with the Putai Party and the previous government. Not that we aren't very concerned about them. We are. We've issued statements about them. They should never have been arrested. But it is extending the reach of military targets to people who really have nothing to do with the partisan political fighting inside Thailand, just people who basically have become rights defenders. You know, it's not so different, and they wouldn't like to hear this, but not so different than what the Chinese do. The Thai military has now taken the view that you're with us or you're against us, and if you're against us, you are subject to arrest. And if you are arrested, you do not receive due process. You only can fight your case in a Thai military court, which is not independent, not impartial. And it remains to be seen whether people will really be given an opportunity to defend themselves in that venue. We just don't know right now.
The Thai military has tightened its grip on power. Were you surprised by the extent of the military crackdown?
There's two ways to look at this. One is that there have been a lot of Thai coups by the military over the years, and they tend to be short-lived affairs. They tend to be aimed at a very particular outcome that allows them to create the context for the next government to be elected. And they don't reach very far beyond the specific targets, you know, the politicians involved. On the other hand, this has been brewing for a very long time. The instability in Thailand has been going on for a long time. The military and elements of the opposition, led by Suthep, former deputy of the Democratic Party, have been trying for a long time to reach this outcome. And the other school of thought, which I think is more likely, is that they really plan a much wider, more repressive campaign targeting many more people to try to get rid of Thaksin Shinawatra and anybody related to him once and for all. And to do that, you have to shut down dissent very broadly. You have to target people who have nothing to do with Thaksin but who would be opposed to the military taking power for a while. And that's what we're really worried about. You know, will this be a more typical Thai coup that lasts weeks and months and then they announce an election date? Or is this something much more sinister where they'll hold on to power for much longer and really try to wipe out whole sections of political opinion in Thailand? And that could be very dangerous because there is a very highly politicized and mobilized opposition that doesn't just support Thaksin but opposes the people who are behind this coup. We've been warning and others have been warning for a long time that if they went this far, there could be a very strong public reaction involving large-scale protests and ultimately maybe large-scale violence by the security forces against protesters.
Thailand has been racked by 6 months of political disputes and sometimes violent demonstrations. Thailand's army has staged 12 coups in the last 80 years.
China is a fascinating country.
With interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own, American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio.
And anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook VOA Asia.
The UN says hunger kills more people every year than AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis combined. Despite progress since 1990, it's estimated more than 840 million people still do not have enough to eat. Nevertheless, the director of the Bread for the World Institute says recent efforts can bring a dramatic improvement. VOA's Joe DeCapwell reports.
Asma Latif says the opportunity exists to tackle hunger on a sustained basis and not just address emergency situations.
Well, I think we're in a good space right now. I think for the first time in human history, we have the prospect of ending global hunger within a generation by 2030.
The Bread for the World Institute is a Christian-based organization providing strategies to end world hunger. Latif says achieving the potential to ensure food security has been a joint effort.
This has been due to a lot of deliberate work on the part of governments around the world, particularly the governments of countries that are hardest hit by hunger, but also by the support of the United States and the leadership of the United States.
The 1996 UN World Food Summit issued the Rome Declaration. It called for reducing by half the number of chronically undernourished people by 2015. However, Latif says at the time, there was no unified strategy as to how to do that.
There was a great focus on industrialization. I think people felt that if you helped countries develop and have economic growth, that would address hunger as well. And so you did find, actually, a huge reduction in extreme poverty around the world, but that didn't translate into necessarily at the same pace a reduction in hunger.
She says the focus on how to fight hunger changed during the 2008 food security crisis, as high prices and shortages affected many countries.
It was the global response that came as a result of that food price crisis. It was a real wake-up call. Riots around the world as people were really struggling to be able to afford food, and prices of basic commodities had just skyrocketed. That got the attention of a lot of policymakers, including U.S. leaders at the time. And since then, the Obama administration has really made food security and hunger a priority within global development programs and has galvanized global attention to this issue.
Leaders realized that food security was a threat to national security. Latif says policies developed during the food crisis have made a difference.
You know, we're very close to achieving the Millennium Development Goal of halving hunger by 2015. We won't make that target because it's next year and because of the food price crisis. But the effort that's been put in over the last few years really puts us on track.
The Bread for the World Institute director says currently enough food is being produced to feed everyone on the planet. The problem, she says, is that many people cannot afford it or gain access to it. And a lot of food is wasted every year by poor harvesting and inadequate storage and transportation. It's estimated the world population will grow from about 7 billion to 9 billion by 2050. As a result, the emphasis in recent years has been on investing in smallholder farms and making them much more efficient.
With growing population, as well as with the impact of climate change on food security, there will be a need to really become more innovative and make use of all the available arable land and get more out of the land than we currently do. In Africa, a lot of the land is not being used to its full potential.
Latif praises the U.S. government's recent Feed the Future Progress report, saying it links livelihoods to smallholder farm investments. She calls on the U.S. and others to ensure those investments are made over the long term. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Pope Francis today urged followers of Islam, Judaism, and Christianity to respect one another as brothers and sisters and never abuse God's name through violence. He made the plea on the third and final day of his Middle Eastern pilgrimage during a visit to the Dome of the Rock, located at the third holiest spot in Islam, where Muslims believe the Prophet Muhammad ascended to heaven. The mosque compound is built on Judaism's holiest site, where the biblical first and second temples are believed to have stood. Francis's next stop was the Western Wall, where he bowed his head in prayer for a few minutes. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On May 26, 1538, the Swiss city of Geneva expelled Protestant reformer John Calvin and his followers from the town. Calvin lived in exile in Strasbourg for the next 3 years. In 1647, Elsa Young was hanged in Hartford, Connecticut, becoming the first woman to be executed as a witch in the British American colonies. Witchcraft was punishable by death in Connecticut until 1715. In 1868, the U.S. Senate came within a single vote of removing President Andrew Johnson from office. Charges were brought against the president when he illegally removed his Secretary of War from office. But the real cause of Johnson's impeachment in the U.S. House of Representatives was probably political differences that emerged after the Civil War. On this day in 1896, Wall Street Journal editor Charles Dow published the first Dow Jones Index, derived from various important American industries, a means he believed would give readers a better understanding of how the stock market was doing. More than 100 years later, stock investors still keep their eyes on the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Also in 1896, Nicholas II became Tsar of Russia. The last of Russia's monarchs was forced to abdicate his throne in 1917. Nicholas and his family were later shot to death by Bolsheviks during the Communist Revolution. In 1897, the horror classic Dracula was published. The novel by Bram Stoker has been made into many movies over the years. Dracula began a public fascination with vampires that continues to this day. In 2004, Terry Nichols was found guilty of 161 state murder charges for helping carry out the Oklahoma City bombing. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
Like many nations, the United States pauses each year to honor those who died in its defense through military service. The custom is an ancient one, recalling a speech by the Athenian statesman Pericles that the casualties of war are worthy men, and the living need not have a more heroic spirit. On Monday, March 26th, Memorial Day, in communities across America, there will be speeches striking similar themes, and a moment of silence will be observed. Like the poppies in Flanders Fields, small flags will be seen among the graves in the nation's many military cemeteries, and the families of the fallen will stop to remember. Beyond mere ceremony, the day represents a debt paid by the living to those Americans who made the ultimate sacrifice to ensure their country's freedom. Some died in battle, some of disease. Others were lost in foreign prisons and never returned. Most died very young, defending their nation's ideals and liberties, perhaps even before they had much of a chance to fully appreciate them. Hundreds of thousands died, fighting to make others free too, in North Africa, Europe, the Pacific, Asia, and the Middle East. Memorial Day honors no single battle or war. Its meaning transcends heroic monuments. Rather, it is the recognition by a grateful nation that lives and blood lost in defense of its freedoms are never given in vain.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.